KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You are listening to KBOO News In Depth. I'm Althea Billings. Juneteenth is a federal holiday commemorating the end of slavery in the United States. It's celebrated on June 19th because that's the day in 1865 when Major General Gordon Granger ordered the final enforcement of the Emancipation Proclamation in Galveston, Texas at the end of the Civil War. But some commentators believe that many of today's Juneteenth celebrations have lost their political edge. Marsha Coleman Adebayo is the president of the Bethesda African Cemetery Coalition in Maryland. She spoke with KBOO contributor David Rosenberg earlier this month about the true significance of Juneteenth, as well as the coalition's fight to save Moses Cemetery and the related conflict with Maryland Congressman Jamie Raskin.
Do you think a lot of the Juneteenth celebrations have been toned down into just kind of street parties and have lost their original meaning? Or do you think they've been pretty consistent about getting certain messages out that are political?
I think it's an interesting question. First of all, Juneteenth is obviously very important. It signaled the ability of Black troops to interfere and break up a system that was designed to force people into submission. And the troops in Galveston, I don't quite buy the idea that the Africans in Galveston were unaware that other parts of the country, in fact, had experienced some form of liberalization of their treatment in this country. That would just go against all of the intuitive and essential understanding we have of how complex the communication system was between African communities. And so I think what we were looking at in Galveston was a system that was so barbaric and so primitive in terms of its use of violence that once other parts of the country began to sort of, you know, move away from some of the more barbaric aspects of kidnapping and human bondage, the system in Texas became even tighter and more difficult and more violent. So the Black troops that intervened to break that kind of depravity were, I think, were showing themselves to be efficient and to be professional in terms of their ability to fight these reactionary forces in the South. So I think the spirit of Juneteenth, which is a spirit of breaking bondage and fighting for freedom. Remember, a lot of the white forces in the South have been involved in these covenants to enforce the enslavement. I hate to use that word because it's such a colonial term, but just the only word that I can always think of is barbarism of this system. And they were slave patrollers. And so when the Southern forces began to actually see these Black men with guns, it counteracted a lot of the initial notions of who they were fighting, quite frankly. So it was an amazing period of history where it all comes together, you know, where the Black troops are saying, you know, give us the gun and we will take our freedom. And that is what Harriet Tubman said later on when she was invited to the White House to take a picture with Abraham Lincoln, and she declined. And she said, you know, you didn't free us, meaning Europeans, abolitionists, you didn't free us. We freed ourselves. So the story of Galveston is just incredibly important in terms of Black troops taking control and determining the course of history for their own people. So do I think that kind of spirit is being reflected in the Juneteenth celebrations? And I think the answer is obviously no. And I think at this point, this notion of the kind of independence and the fight and the strength and the resistance against white supremacy that the Black troops showed in Galveston, and not only Galveston, but across the country, provides lessons that we all need to learn and relearn these lessons. I mean, one of the problems that we face, obviously, in Maryland is that our history has been so whitewashed. It's been so gummed down that to some extent, our people not reflecting the spirit of Galveston because they simply don't know the story. They don't know the kind of courage and valor it took for these Black troops to pick up the gun and to fight for their freedom. So I think clearly...
Mostly it's the idea that they found out that they were free and they didn't know, but you're saying that the communication was
I think that's more effective
than some people think.
Oh, more complex than other people think. I mean, when you think about the systems of communications that were developed by these Africans, it's really quite amazing. You know, from small African girls braiding, having their hair cornrowed in the patterns of maps that, you know, were being covered up by their headdress, to the language that people were able to somehow piece together to explain how to move to freedom, to the drumming system and to the music that was developed, which indicated, you know, paths to freedom, to the songs that people were creating, very complex, involved systems of communications. So I think it would be almost unthinkable. I'm an Africanist by profession. And so it would be almost unthinkable to believe that those kinds of systems broke down within the context of a small area in Galveston or in Texas, when there was so much communication, so much travel going in and out of these areas that people would not have known. I think the institutional violence that the Africans were facing is the primary reason why they weren't able to resist in a way that was effective in terms of being able to free themselves. But then, of course, when the troops came in with the guns and they were authorized to shoot, things completely changed around. So I think that we're looking at a very interesting situation where you actually have a violent encounter with oppressors and the oppressed win. They actually win this situation.
And so today, in terms of the self-empowerment of Black people, there's other groups like yours who are carrying on in that tradition, would you say? Black Panther Party or Black Lives Matter, would that be included in those groups, kind of be included in that?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, there are different ways of struggling against oppression. And certainly the Bethesda African Cemetery Coalition proudly associates with the activist traditions in our community. And we've had to confront the very same system, because remember, the system didn't change. It just basically mutated. And so the systems are still very much in place, which is what you're seeing with the desecration of Moses Cemetery, right? That people still feel that they own the Black body and can manipulate it and desecrate it and move it and do whatever they wish to do with Black bodies. And so as a result of that, you get resistance. And of course, our resistance is one that I think prides itself on being uncompromising in terms of our declaration of who we are. And certainly we see ourselves as well as freedom fighters.
Do you see that some of those people on the right who want to kind of return to another era, do you see that they kind of accept certain Black voices, Black leaders who agree with them, that they want to say that they're inclusive? You know, they like people like Condoleezza Rice and Clarence Thomas and what's his name, the writer, Thomas Sowell or Sal, you know, people like that. And then they could say, well, we're not against Black people or other dark-skinned people. We don't want people to identify with the left. You know, I think that's sort of their argument, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think the plantation system is still very much in force here. So when we're talking about systems, political systems, and how they operate, the system of white supremacy has always taken advantage of Black people who are prepared to surrender their own notions of freedom in order to take advantage of white supremacy. So, you know, from overseers on what we call death camps, European historians call them plantations, to Black politicians who, you know, who provide cover for white supremacy. I mean, it's the same system, but it's not confined to Black people. I mean, every single ethnic group will have a sector of their ethnic, of their group, who are prepared to make these kinds of compromises. And in that sense, you know, the Black community is not different than any other community.
Although they would say the Black leadership is, or the most Black leaders and Black organizations are being fooled by accepting these, what are known as left of center ideas, and that they should really embrace a more individualistic, less government interference outlook. So they bill themselves as, in a way, fighting for freedom for all. But you're saying that that's not true.
No, I think it's just the same plantation system, you know, where you, and I think that that's a fairly small group of people, but it's a very dangerous group of people, because they are able to tap into resources because of their, you know, willingness to compromise basic principles, and then to try to communicate those. I mean, one of the problems that we've had with our struggle, in fact, is the system here, which is supposed to be a very liberal system, which is just, I think it's been exposed through this struggle. You know, what they've done to counteract us is to find Black people who they will appoint as director of this or chairman of this. And they expect that appointment to cause confusion in our group. But we're historians, you know, we're social scientists. And so we've seen this pattern over and over again in history. And so for us, we're just not mesmerized by it at all. And for us, we really do not care whether or not the director is Black or white. We are very focused on the positions that they take. And when they're Black and they take right-wing positions, we call them out just as much as we would call a white person out.
Looking at the national scene in the country today, what sort of hope would you have for a kind of more liberated, more just, more humane society?
Well, it's obviously somewhat of a difficult situation we're in now, isn't it? I think the struggles have to continue. You know, we're looking at, you know, two very disappointing presidential candidates, obviously. And, you know, to a large extent, to the extent that Democrats and Republicans are the two political parties in this country, we're not looking at a wide breadth of political ideas. But I think what's happened with that is that at the grassroots level, people are beginning to organize because they've lost faith in the two-party system. And I think that that is where our hope must lie, is the fact that people are now beginning to take their futures in their hands and not expecting politicians to provide leadership. So it's a very interesting perspective, I think. And what I'm seeing as someone who's at the grassroots, organizing and struggling at the grassroots level, is just the amazing amount of talent and creativity and commitment there is in our community to fight white supremacy and to fight other kinds of evils in our society. So I think leadership is really being developed at the bottom at this point. And the question is whether or not you can maintain that integrity as leadership begins to move closer to the top.
Do you find that you run into people with whom you might bring up any number of issues, like what's happening in Gaza or immigration or conditions of low-wage workers, and all they want to talk about is Trump, 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 and how to stop Trump, and that's the only issue that matters? Do you run into that a lot?
No. I don't know anyone who wants to talk about Trump. Or Biden, except to talk about Gaza, I suppose. No. People are really focused on their issues. I mean, people are focused on housing. People are focused on immigration. People are focused, and they realize these leaders don't really represent them. And so I don't think, at least in my community, I don't think people really spend almost any time talking about these people. You know, we had a meeting Thursday night when it was announced that Trump had been convicted on felony charges, and not one person raised the issue in a two-hour meeting. It's just irrelevant to most of us.
What about the issue of reparations? How important is that in achieving more liberation?
I think it's central. Absolutely. I think it's a central struggle for people to understand how they've been oppressed and the lack of intergenerational resources to finance a future under this kind of society. So in the River Rose situation, you have one of the wealthiest communities in the world in Bethesda, Maryland. And it was created on the genocide of Native people, of course, and then they kidnapped Africans and brought them here. And then you have this African community that arises from the rubble of what we call European barbarism or slavery, and they are thriving. You have one woman, Charlotte Gray, who is just, you know, an entrepreneur for excellent. And she's buying land. She is such an entrepreneur that she is just buying every piece of land that's available for Black people to buy, because not, you know, Black people only could buy certain parcels of land. And she buys it. In fact, she buys so much land in Bethesda that they actually rename a portion of Bethesda, Grayville, to honor her. I mean, of course, none of this finds its way in history books. And then you have the Warren family, and you have the Brown family. You have all these families that come together. They create a church called Macedonia Baptist Church. They create families. They create schools. And this is in the midst of segregation. This is in the midst of just horrific oppression. And yet they create this community that's self-sufficient and thriving. Then the European community sees this thriving community, and they decide, well, we simply can't have this kind of example because it flies in the face of white supremacy. And so they decide, and not only that, but then they decide, once the African community demonstrates that the land that they thought was agriculturally non-productive could actually grow food. So once they realize, oh my goodness, we allowed these people to buy this land that we thought was useless, and now they're actually growing food there, and they're raising livestock there, and they're producing in this area, they decide, well, we have to steal it. We have to take this back. And so then you get the development of a KKK in this area that works in close collaboration with the powers that be. And you actually have a paper called Scatter the Negroes, which sort of outlines exactly how they're going to disenfranchise this community. And then you fast forward to the early 1960s, and every property owned by Black people on River Road has been confiscated or stolen through this collaboration with the KKK and Montgomery County Police and the politicals who made up the Montgomery County political circle.
And when the rest of the country hears about Bethesda, we hear about the hospital.
So the only thing people know about Bethesda is NIH. When people think of Bethesda, they think of NIH, and that's it. They have no idea about the history of this community. I'm not from Bethesda. I'm actually from Michigan. So I have become fascinated with this, with the history, because it is such a history of a resilience, of fighting against fighting against oppression, losing in some instances, quite frankly, because every single home was lost here. And so, and that means the intergenerational wealth of this community was taken away and given to other people. At the same time, you have the hidden story of what happened. I mean, the obvious story is that, yes, all the homes were confiscated. They were all stolen. What you don't realize is that when they built a church called Macedonia, this community found a way of staying together despite the fact that their homes have been taken away, their property had been taken away. And now in 2024, you still have a Macedonia Baptist Church that brings together this descendant community in one place every Sunday. And that was the way we were able to stitch the story together, because we still had a descendant community that could tell the story. So that's an amazing story in and of itself. And so because of that, we've been able to understand some of the mechanisms of how people fight oppression. And sometimes you look at the obvious issues of where they lost their homes or they lost everything. But at the same time, this is a community that understood that if they were able to save a central institution, that maybe 20, 30 years down the road, researchers would come along because they had saved that institution and begin to piece together the story of what happened to them. And that is what happened on River Road. So it's in many ways, it's still this amazing story. And the people we've met who survived what we call the Ma'afa, the genocide on River Road, are some of the strongest and most, you know, incredible people you've met, because they have faced the worst the society can throw at them, and yet they're still standing.
Anything else you want to add about Juneteenth or what's going on at Moses Cemetery or related issues?
We're actually raising the Juneteenth flag at Congressman Jamie Raskin's office. Jamie Raskin is considered a very liberal, pro-democratic leader of some sort. Yet Moses Cemetery is actually in his district. He actually attended Juneteenth last year and made a conscious decision that he was not going to stop the desecration and that he was going to side with the developer.
What reason did he give?
You know, he really didn't give any reason. If you go to his website, you will see what we consider a pathetic press release that he issued on the issue of desecration, which basically says, I'm opposed to desecration, and I support a piece of legislation that will provide a little bit of money to various communities to clean up their cemeteries. The problem, of course, is that the cemetery that he represents has been totally and completely desecrated. There is nothing to clean up. It's just, you know, it's covered in cement, and he did nothing to stop it. So there is nothing to clean up in his part of the world. And still he wants to talk about democracy and the power of the people and all this nonsense. So we intend to raise the Juneteenth flag in his office to honor our ancestors and to make a statement, quite frankly, about raising this flag in a hostile environment, which we consider Jamie Raskin's office to be a hostile environment.
Have you had any communication with his office recently?
No, but, you know, we've just sent out the press release today, so we'll see what happens in the next couple of hours. And then after that, we're going to, on June 18th, we're going to have, you know, a commemoration of the Ma'afa, which is the genocide. And as I said, we just had a large portion of the cemetery covered in cement just 2 weeks ago. So people can say, you know, you can't blame me for what my great-grandparents did. This is 2 weeks ago. That they decided that they were going to cover this cemetery, which is a known cemetery, in cement. And they know that this is a cemetery. They know this is a cemetery where young African girls who had been forced into pregnancy. About 60% of those little girls died. They bled out during pregnancy. And their bodies were thrown in this cemetery. So they're trying to cover up the history because, after all, Bethesda, no one in Bethesda would do anything like that. And so they're trying to cover up their history. And so the second event that we'll have, which will be on June 19th is the community Juneteenth, and then June 18th is the Ma'afa, where we're asking everyone to come and take pictures of the desecration and then to distribute those through social media, so that everyone across the country will be able to see what they've done to an African burial ground. And then we're going to have enactment, Civil War enactment soldiers who are literally going to march down River Road the way the KKK used to march down River Road, and they're going to lead the demonstration to the cemetery. And we're honoring a Civil War hero named Private William H.H. Brown, who is actually buried under the cement at Moses African Cemetery. And Private Brown fought in two of the bloodiest battles of the Civil War and survived two of the bloodiest battles in Civil War. But he didn't survive the desecration by at the hands of Montgomery County government. And so his desecrated and torn apart body is under the concrete. And so we're developing a beautiful wreath that we're going to hang on the side of this desecration to remember Private Brown. And we're going to have the enactment soldiers talk about the life of Private Brown. And we're calling for the recovery and return of his remains to the community. All of this is on the table of Jamie Raskin, who's supposed to be this liberal. And people are surprised because one would think this would be on the desk of someone from Alabama, Mississippi. But then one has to remember that more Black men are incarcerated in Maryland than Alabama or Mississippi.
But then, so Raskin wouldn't have direct control over this, right? It would be maybe the city council or the county board of supervisors or some other body, right? I mean, Raskin is in the House, right?
Raskin is in the House. And when you think, and I used to work for Congress, and so I realized, and he obviously does, the power of that seat. He could literally go to the floor once a day and make a statement about the desecration going on in his community. He could introduce legislation that would make it a criminal offense to carry out the kind of desecration that's occurred in his district. He could be as bold as someone like a Congressman Walter Fauntroy or so many other early members of the Congressional Black Caucus who would march with Dr. King on the weekends and still make their roll call on Tuesday. So his seat is very powerful. And so if he wanted to, he could have stopped this desecration. The same is true for any other member, but particularly Congress. And when you realize that the developers used PPP money, almost $40 million, I believe, during COVID. I mean, so there's a lot of federal funds that have gone into the desecration. We could have had congressional hearings on this. And it's interesting because desecration is an area where you actually can get Republican as well as Democrats to say, we're opposed to desecration. We're opposed to grave robbing. It's one issue that should cross party lines, if nothing else does. But we've not been able to get one Democrat, one elected official to condemn desecration. Not one.
Do you get the feeling or the impression that they would be more likely to do so if it was a Native American burial ground?
Perhaps. We don't know, because certainly there should be Native American remains in this area, because this is all obviously an area where Native Americans lived. I think what we're really facing is the fact that Montgomery County is in the stronghold of developers. And when you begin to address the issue of property rights, land rights, you are encroaching upon the issue of development. And because this is one of their chief areas, because it's such a, you know, prosperous community, privileged community, I think the elected officials are just simply terrified of taking on the issue of property rights and land ownership. So even in the face of something as disgusting as desecration or robbing, and there's been a lot of grave robbing at Moses Cemetery, we have about 30,000 photographs. So, you know, we found a lot of grave robbing. These politicians are absolutely too terrified to speak out against it.
That was Marsha Coleman Adebayo of the Bethesda African Cemetery Coalition speaking with KBOO contributor David Rosenberg about the significance of Juneteenth. They spoke about her coalition's fight to save Moses Cemetery. You've been listening to KBOO News In Depth. I'm Althea Billings. Thanks for being with us. Thank you.
KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming online at kbu.fm.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934.